Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer. So if all the world's a stage, all the city's at least a short story, Thomas Beller, a writer, has a less than ethereal explanation for the glut of good stories about New York City. Density, he says. More people, more writers. That's just per capita logic. He goes beyond that. He says density puts each of us in each other's face, and you can't help but notice things. Lost and Found is the second book of short nonfiction from the website Mr. Beller's Neighborhood. Mr. Beller joins me now. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
And also one of the contributors to the book. He wrote a couple very funny essays. Saeed. All right, I'm going to do it.
Go ahead.
Seraphizadeh.
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 Perfect.
Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thanks.
What makes a good Mr. Beller's Neighborhood story?
Oh, something with a beginning and an end.
That's any story.
True, but, you know, it's not something to be taken for granted when you're publishing things online where things are usually have more polemic and to inflame or antagonize or make a point. And so you sort of have to reiterate that it's meant to be a story, a slice of life.
Yeah. And it's the scope of what counts as stories is pretty wide. There are first-person anecdotes. Some of these could have run in film comment, like there was a piece about the film The Warriors in Coney Island.
Yeah.
Some are just pure memoir. Some comment on the state of the hospital system in the city. So you want to go for everything that's about locations in New York and the experience of living in New York?
Yeah, the book has a very, very broad array of experience that it's culling from, ranging from memoirs, pieces by firefighters to sort of absurd events that happen to people as they're going from place A to place B. In fact, one of the nice descriptions I heard about the book from Patrick Gallagher, who's helped me with the whole project, is that a lot of the material in the book is derived from parts of life that are interstitial. It's the in-between places where you're going, you're not in your home, you're not at work, you're sort of en route, and something entirely unexpected happens. And the challenge of the site and that hopefully bears fruit in the book is not just to tell the story as a sort of dinner party anecdote, but to give it some shape. And that's why I said, you know, it needs a beginning and an end and ideally a middle, because we're trying to move a little bit beyond a newspaper form exactly into something that's more literary.
As the editor, do you go out and say this part of the city or this part of the New York experience is underrepresented? Let's try to solicit that. Or do you just kind of take what comes over the transom and you're overwhelmed as it is?
Mostly the latter, but there's a definite awareness that are huge swaths of city life that are not terribly well represented on the site. And I'm always eager to encourage that. I had a very intense exchange with one of the few African-American contributors, Denise Campbell, who did a series of wonderful pieces essentially about being gentrified out of her one neighborhood, Fort Greene, and then later out of another neighborhood. She addressed other subjects, but it was a pretty intense and candid exchange about where she fits in this. And I said, Look, you're living in the city and you can write. That's where you fit in. That's the only criterion.
Well, obviously, the book's about 700 pages. I read about 15 of the stories, but I came across one by Ennis
Smith.
Yeah, so he also African-American and wrote about gentrification.
That's a wonderful piece set in the northern reaches of Manhattan in a sort of war zone-like decimated environment that is nevertheless, you know, filled with people, one of whom is a very cantankerous, irritable, white superintendent that over the years he becomes quite close to. That's a lovely piece. That piece has this great image of when they finally clean the place up, this heavy machinery reaching down over the lip of Manhattan to pull out cars, tires, all sorts of wreckage, this kind of bizarre excavation that took place.
And if you were said, well, what we definitely need is a half Iranian, half Jewish contributor,
then I'd be the one for that.
So did you know about the site? Were you a writer looking for an outlet, or did you say, I got to write something for Mr. Beller's Neighborhood?
Well, Thomas and I met playing basketball, actually, on Horatio Street, in which he's written a bunch of great pieces about hoops. And he actually encouraged me to contribute something. This was back, I think, in 2000 when the site first went up. And I remember he also offered me a monetary. He said the low two figures. I wrote something, speaking of polemical, which he turned down. and said, you need to think of yourself as a character in this story, which I don't think I'd ever really done before.
Yeah.
And it began to sort of get the wheels turning to talk about my experience in a different way. And one of the first pieces I wrote was about 9/11. And then it's sort of just like after that, I think I've contributed about 10 or so pieces to the site.
The two in there, the anthology, have this in common. You're seeking medicine of one sort or another, and you run against a big weight, a weight online at the Duane Reade.
That's
and
true.
Your long piece, The Afflicted, is about your girlfriend getting stitches and the weight in the hospital. But the Duane Reade one was really funny. They're both funny. But in both of them, there's this internal dialogue where you're really cowardly in your own head. And I was just wondering, is that, you know, how much is that kind of sweetened in post-production, as they'd say in the movies, and how much was actually going on and you're aware of it, having these discussions with a guy who objects to the fact that you're protesting the war, or maybe he's just a little crazy?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing is I don't necessarily think of the pieces as funny. I see them. I'm aware of the absurdity of them.
Yeah.
I don't think I do any post-production work in it. It's the ability to admit what's going on in my head that's important for me, especially when it comes to racial politics, especially the war in Duane Reade, where I'm not sure if the man I'm talking to is black or Puerto Rican, and et cetera, et cetera.
And the counter girl who's Caribbean, or maybe she's not.
That's right. That's right. That's funny that you point out the weight. I didn't realize the parallel between the two.
You think he's funny, right, Tom? I mean, he maybe not knowing it makes him funnier.
He's an incredibly enjoyable writer to read.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about the Duane Reade. They did this whole rebranding, and I think we both agree, and many New Yorkers do, that Duane Reade's a pretty sad place. Do you think the rebranding makes it less sad?
I have no idea about the rebranding.
Oh, you haven't seen
it? No.
Well,
I'm looking forward to the corporate logo
has swishes and swooshes, and, you know, my take is it used to be a place that was definitely something, which is kind of like you write. Oh, I have the quote here somewhere, but, you know, sad. And I think the makeover just makes it blah. Which is maybe even more sad.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
It now has less personality.
Less personality, but what it does have ain't good.
Right. I think I said something about it. There's a feeling of a pudding atmosphere in the stores.
How much editing do you do, or are there other editors on the site? Will you kick back a piece a few times before it's ready to go?
Sometimes. Over the years, it's been coming up on... it's over 9 years the site's been up, and this is the second book that's come out of it. I ran it pretty much alone for a few years and then gathered in a whole wonderful group of editors, Liz Grove, Brian Charles, who himself is a fantastic writer, Patrick Gallagher, and now Jean-Paul Cattaviella, who now kind of sit at the receiving end of all the pieces that come in. And it is edited. It's an absurd task. It's like desalinating the ocean or something, because pieces come in all the time, and it's not a profit-making initiative. In fact, it's been really jarring over the years. I started the site as a venue for the kind of writing that I always like to do, and I thought, well, if it can't be sold, it'll just end up here. And then in the last 9 years, the places that I used to sell my own work to and that would publish pieces like this have been contracting and diminishing.
Yeah. I mean, like The Atlantic no longer takes short fiction. I don't know if you wrote for them. The New Yorker they still do okay.
I'm not talking about fiction. It's a nonfiction site. I'm talking more about this kind of urban sketch, this vignette.
Yeah.
You know, you would see someone like, just on a newspaper level, like Jimmy Breslin or Murray Kempton or someone like that practicing this, just as a matter of course. But that kind of piece that's not so useful and newsy and provocative has sort of receded from the pages of most of those publications that have the word New York in them these
right,
days.
Right, right. Or, you know, Royko in Chicago, Bill Geist did that in New York. Is it that? Why do you think that is? Because your site proves that the talent is out there.
Well, this is edging into that extremely dicey and anxiety-making subject of what's going on in the world of journalism and publishing and print publication and the struggles that these institutions that you never could imagine struggling are going
right.
through, like the New York Times.
But the kind of pieces you're describing were the most popular things in those papers when done well, when, you know, Mike Royko could talk about the characters in Chicago.
True enough. I do think there's something curious going on there. I don't want to attempt to address it because it's epic in scope, and it's subject for a lot of anxiety and discussion. I do want to chime in when you asked if I thought that Saeed's writing was funny. It is very funny, but it's not overtly comedic. It's that Saeed, like a lot of the authors who end up writing for this site, is rather anxious, rather nervous, and that anxiety creates all kinds of interesting situations and self-consciousnesses and foibles that then get explored and sort of teased out in the piece.
And the sort of thing in the long hospital piece called The Afflicted, I mean, it's not that long. It's like, what, 15 pages? You know, funny cast of characters, or you mine them for humor. And then little vignettes of your own life, you know, your dad leaving you and your sister leaving you when she was 9, that were integrated so well. Was that something that you always wanted to put in the piece? Where did you have to be encouraged to get more personal at those moments? Or was that what you were actually thinking in the hospital as you waited? You thought about your own life?
Oh, that's a good question. I think when I first began writing it, one of the things was within the first page, I mentioned something about not knowing how to react to my girlfriend's the laceration on her finger. And then immediately in my mind was that I had never had a father who had done that for me. And I think it just organically came out of that, that I would cut back and forth, which is something that I've done often in my writing. And in fact, I just have to say that the memoir that I do on Tom's site, and it was really the first opportunity for me to do that, ended up kind of folding into my full-length memoir through a series of events of people, editors at other magazines, seeing my writing and then encouraging me to explore those themes further of growing up communist, et cetera. But it's on Mr. Beller's Neighborhood where that really began.
Is there any type of story that you're just sick of, like crazy roommate stories, Tom?
I think if anything is done well, I'm not sick
yeah.
of it.
Yeah. And you mentioned that the site doesn't make money. Did the books at least eke out a little profit for
well,
you?
Well, this one just came out.
Yeah.
How'd
the 9/11 book do?
It did okay. I mean, it was an awkward thing to publish because I think it was valued by a lot of people. It was in production as a perfectly innocent collection of New York stories when 9/11 happened, and then the site turned into one of the many, many venues where people just put their sort of testimony of the experience, and we ended up doing a kind of double A-side front and back book mm-hmm. that came out fairly soon. And some people I've heard from were extremely grateful to have just something to relate to. And a few people seemed to think it was opportunistic, but anything focused on New York City was going to imbibe what that 9/11 experience was and try to make sense of it. And in some ways, this book, Lost and Found, you know, it's a 7-year gap between what was called Before and After Stories from New York and Lost and Found Stories from New York. And part of the reason for that long period of time, it's not for a shortage of material. There were about 1,000 pieces that had to be culled to this volume, which has about 120 writers in it. Part of it was just kind of, it took a lot of time to get one's bearings and make sense of the world in New York to the extent it can ever be made sense of in the wake of that tragedy on 9/11.
You know, I'm sure you get all sorts of reactions to the individual pieces, and the reading all of them or many of them at a time, a feeling washes over you. Here was my feeling. When I would read about different parts of town that I haven't been to or have never been to in a while, I found myself getting almost upset with myself. Like, what am I doing spending the bulk of my time in my own neighborhood? There's so much other stuff out there, even if it's not pleasant, like someone with a crazy neighbor who's living in, you know, down in Westbeth or something. I really was
Kate
a little,
Walter, yeah.
Maybe this is very New York, but I was upset with myself that I was living an insular life in, you know, the biggest metropolis in the world.
No, I think that's something everyone who lives here experiences, and I'm glad that you had that reaction looking at the book, because the neighborhood aspect of the city is one of its great strengths. That's how you sort of keep sane. And at the same time, you do end up living a very oddly small town life in this huge place. And 20 years go by, you've never set foot in Queens.
The title of the book is Lost and Found. That's also the title of a short story that you wrote. You wrote about, what, 4 or 5
yep.
stories for the book. So you wrote, you know, you're the editor. You founded the site. You get to name the story after yourself.
Yeah.
That's your prerogative. I get that. My favorite one that you wrote was called Pursuits. And what I liked about it was you witnessed a funny thing happen in one part of town, a sort of a weird breakup. And instead of telling the story of the breakup, you took a step back and told the story of the conversation you had with the guy next to you about the breakup, which made it quintessentially New York.
Hey, I love that guy, Nick Spicer. We became friends in the heels of that conversation. Yeah, well, you know, the pieces that I write that I include in this book are very narrowly focused on events usually. They're not that much on the personal essay mode. I find myself getting into very strange situations and I feel compelled to just write it down in a kind of diaristic way. And I've always done that. I've always tried to sell that kind of piece. And it was giving a venue for that sort of piece that motivated making the site, which has led to Lost and Found and so forth.
Thomas Beller, founder and editor of Open City Magazine and the editor of Lost and Found Stories from New York. And Saeed, here we go.
Serafizadeh.
Thanks, guys. I'm Mike Peskin for Brian Lehrer.
Thank you. Yeah.